With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. You're listening to Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I have a great deal of respect for economist Judith Sloan, and she's written an outstanding article today in the Australian newspaper that I wanted to mention on the program and push you towards reading if you can get that chance. But the headline of the story kind of sums up exactly where her argument's heading. Bowen, as in Chris Bowen, the climate change minister, cannot suppress nuclear debate with selective facts. I'm so glad someone is calling this bloke out for selectively talking about nuclear. She writes, if climate change and energy minister Chris Bowen is so certain nuclear power is too expensive for Australia, he has every reason to lift the legislative ban and let the markets work that out. The reality is he can't be completely confident of his position, and he is reluctant to enter into a bun fight with the left of his party and the Greens that inevitably would occur should there be a proposal to lift the legal prohibition on nuclear power. It's worth recalling here why this prohibition exists in the first place. It goes back to 1998 and the passing of the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Bill to secure a replacement for the nuclear reactor at Lucas Heights in Sydney, that is the source of our medical isotopes. The coalition government agreed to a demand by the Greens that nuclear power be prohibited by law. With cheap, abundant coal-fired power available, there didn't seem a compelling reason to reject the request to pass the law. So it was incumbent at the time on governments to keep accessing coal-fired power. But now the Greens are telling us to shut down the coal-fired power stations, or as they do in Victoria, blow them up. So where does that leave the promise the coalition made on nuclear? The argument is quite obvious here. That agreement should be off the table. That agreement should be null and void, and Australia should be an adult and get rid of the ban on nuclear power. Judith writes, if we fast forward to the present, however, the ban on nuclear power looks like an anachronism as more and more countries around the world embrace the option of zero emissions nuclear power, and the industry as a whole enjoys a remarkable renaissance. There you go. At last year's COP28 UN climate talks in the United Arab Emirates, the final agreement called for accelerating the deployment of low emissions technology, including nuclear power. This, writes Judith, was a significant development in the history of COP. Where's the Australian government on this? Trying to come up with selective facts to besmirch the reputation of more modern technology related to nuclear power. That's not what governments are supposed to do. They don't pick sides, unless, of course, they've done their due diligence, and they've done no due diligence on nuclear power, certainly no due diligence on modern small nuclear reactors at all. At all. Forget about what you heard from the CSIRO. It has been hammered by experts throughout the world, not just in Australia. Well done to Judith Sloan. I implore you to read it because there's plenty more that she writes about and proves that Chris Bowen is so selective when he makes arguments against nuclear. Just in terms of prices, we know what the Reserve Bank did today. They kept interest rates on hold, and I'll speak with Natalia Ilyushina very shortly about that. But retail petrol prices in Australia's five largest cities trended downward in the December quarter 2023, as international refined petrol prices decreased, according to the ACCC's latest quarterly petrol monitoring report. Quarterly average retail petrol prices in Australia's five largest cities were 194.9 cents per litre, a decrease of 0.7. Monthly average retail petrol prices in the five largest cities decreased from 206.6 to 186.6. That's interesting. You know, we still complain about the fact that there are, you know, prices for petrol around the country that are way in excess of what people can afford to pay. And that might still be the case. But I think it's worth noting that in the end of 2023, those petrol prices came off. which is obviously contributing again to the measurement of inflation, which in turn led to today's decision to keep all of that on hold. So 4.35% on hold, steady is the interest rate mark at this stage as inflation continues to ease, thankfully, and economic growth is frozen, stalled, as some are saying. Meanwhile, some relief on power prices, we're told today, as we discussed with Mark Latham, but when you've had your power prices increased by $800-odd, a 20% increase over 2 years, any kind of decrease is just a wee in the bucket. To unpack all of this for us this afternoon, let's hear from research fellow and economist at RMIT University. They call her Dr. Pink, Dr. Natalia Ilushina. Natalia, welcome back to TNT.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. You're wearing pink, suitably enough. Is that why they call you Dr. Pink, is it?
Yeah, evidently. And that's my pink RBA rates tuxedo. I wore it to talk about RBA rates.
Outstanding. Rates decision on hold, steady at 4.35%. What do you construe that to mean? Have we reached a turning point, do you think?
No, not yet. And as Sandra Bullock pointed out, nothing is ruled out and nothing is ruled in. And if last time when she was saying that at the last announcement, I felt it's non-informative and a wishy-washy conversation.
Yeah.
Now, multiple fiscal announcements that happened, I do feel like she just cannot tell us anything because of all the calamity, all the rainfall of all sorts of policies that's happening. It is absolutely impossible to predict anything.
Well, when I heard her say that last time, I thought, well, at least this time they may have a little bit more surety. But you're saying she's in her right to be just as uncertain this time, right?
Look, it's what's happening now. She did mention, though, this time that she does not see her policy inconsistent with fiscal policy, because that's what they've been criticized, that fiscal policy goes one way and they go in another way, namely that there's cost of living support and all sorts of subsidies while they're trying to restrict inflation. Having said that, there's literally in a lot all sorts of announcements of all sorts of fundings. So it feels like every MP wants to suggest some addition to the budget. So in that situation, I don't know how can you predict anything about inflation and employment.
So would the decisions made in the budget impact the next decision by the Reserve Bank?
Absolutely, they will feed into the decision. For example, the tax cuts that already been discussed many times, Sandra admitted that they already are factored in the prediction, but there are more to it. There's all sorts of things. There's cost of living relief, childcare subsidy. There's in all sorts of things that we haven't, that were not still discussed with us. But having said that, we also have migration. And not only that we don't know what is in the budget, we don't know what the consequences of migration is going to be, because we do not know will they get a job, how they will be contributing to the economy, how many relatives they'll bring with them.
But you'd have to, if you were a betting person, you'd have to bet on the fact that the more immigration the more people we bring in, the more pressure there is on inflation to rise. Am I right?
Look, the thing is that you need to see who they are.
Right.
If it's just people who, the numbers, the bodies who come here with bags of money and spending it, yes. If there are people who come here and they are hugely productive and they start producing more than they possibly can consume, the answer is no. And that's why we want immigration. That theoretically, on paper, as a free market economist, it can be good because it increases productivity. Another question is, what's wrong with our own productivity, which has been falling for decades now, which has been documented almost a year ago by Productivity Commission, that we're one of we're championing declining productivity amongst the developed countries.
One of my viewers, listeners, Tony has sent me a message via the chat box on tntradio.live, and he says, by the way, pink looks great, he says. economic growth, zero. Chris, we are in recession and it's going to get a lot worse before anything improves. What do you think about those comments?
Look, there were two figures discussed today on many channels and many media outlets. One is economic growth overall, GDP, and per capita economic growth. And the per capita one is concerning, and that's the one that can be overlooked when we have great numbers, great immigration. It's not zero. Well, depending how the person who contacted you to do, how he likes to round it up or down, it's not zero yet. It's not that bad. But the main problem is productivity and excessive government intervention where it's not needed and no intervention where we need to have this. So we not looking at productivity. None of those policies are looking at productivity. None of them.
Okay, let me talk about this power bill reduction today. I got Mark Latham's view on it a little bit earlier, and he talks about the fact that, well, we've had a 20% increase. Anything that we can get in a reduction is welcome, but it's not going to make too much of a difference to the pressure that people face at the moment. But just explain for us, how is it that they're able to reduce this? It's got nothing to do with the cost of renewables, has it?
Oh, no, it's not nothing to do with cost of renewables. And I've already got an email from my energy provider that the cost will be going down. And the only way I can see it could be happening is that they were having a huge profit margin before, or the original source of producing the electricity is decreasing. Having said that, I cannot see how the renewables can possibly reduce the cost. Because we all know that they're expensive or they're being subsidized, which is, again, if this program is subsidized by the government, we're just putting money from one bucket to another, again, without any increase in productivity somewhere there. And yes, yeah, correctly pointed out, it's been increased between 20 and 30%, actually, depending on the source and everything. And upcoming phasing out of the gas will wipe out that reduction in price. Household gas is cheaper. So you put your stove onto electricity, it will increase your electricity bill, and in total, you will again pay the same. Yes. So what are we talking about? So that's what I'm saying. There's such a huge amount of policy, the rainfall of policy, the shower, whatever, waterfall, whatever you want to call it, that people just get lost in it and no one can even disentangle what's exactly going to happen. All you can do is just count at the end of the month how much more in debt you are.
Yes, thank you very much. You've made me feel really terrific. You're right. It's all down. It's all bad. I want to take a quick break and I'll come back. I want to talk about the 4-day working week, according to Bernie Sanders, and also the renewable investment collapse at the moment, which is really interesting. We'll do all of that with Dr. Pink right after this on TNT.
TNT's David Curtin.
In my mind, government spending in the UK is absolutely horrendous. It has got completely out of control over the last 14 years of Conservative rule and 13 years before that of Labour rule. You would probably be astounded if you actually knew how much the government spent. In this financial year, these are the figures, the estimate for how much it wants to spend on everything, or how much it needs to spend, is £1.2 trillion, or 1.2 million million, if you like, which is an amount of money that we cannot really comprehend.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell
is the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Okay, I've got Dr. Natalia Iloshina with me at the moment from RMIT. Let's start with the renewable story. Straight out of the Australian Financial Review, they've done some work on the investment in renewables at the moment. There's been a drop of 80%. Can you explain to us why that would be the case?
Well, what can I say? Free market responded to the situation. What businesses do, they invest because they expect either high return or low risk. Neither of that is present with the renewable.
Yeah. Right? So there's no risk being taken by anyone in the sector.
Well, there is high risk, so they don't want to take it anymore. That's why they don't want to invest in it anymore. So they invested in the previous years because they're a government-subsidized project that probably were involving more government support and some government reassurance. And now we all know that if energy has to be completely supplied by renewable sources, it's unreliable. So if wind doesn't blow, if sun doesn't shine, and that, which is me being in Melbourne, Victoria, we know that can happen all at the same time. And you will have to deal with all the consequences of that. And recently, when we had the mass outage, when there was 20% of people without electricity, there were lots of claims of compensation for lost groceries. The businesses were asking for compensation. So do you want, as a company, to invest in a source and will be sued for a huge bill? Because we reached the point where the number of renewables sources are such that you will have to single-handedly provide, in some places, the electricity from that source. So you won't have a backup anymore. And that's what market is reacting to, in my opinion. And as I said, so there's so that's high risk. So that's the market response risk is too high. We don't want to invest anymore. And second thing, expecting high return if there's high risk, but high return, there's still interest in investing in that. But we also remember the amount of government subsidy that's required for renewable energy sources to keep going. That's a clear indication that any expectation about huge profits there is quite questionable.
That's interesting. So what can change here? The government won't like the sound of that. The government is pinning all its hope on renewables being our baseload power future, which I believe is unworkable, is impractical. It's been tried elsewhere in the world and failed. So what can they do to change the rate of investment in renewables, do you think? Or can they do anything at all?
Why would we need to change it? Maybe it's time to face the reality. Maybe the market finally heard all the discussions on all the media channels with all the qualified people who know how energy sector works and finally responding to information. You know, I'm about to go in the classroom after you to teach finance, and that's where you say the market knows. So market responded. And maybe that's just the case where efficient information got fed into investor decisions. But on the other note, there is also quite a lot of red tape surrounding, even surrounding the renewables. For example, on a smaller scale, you cannot in an apartment building consume your own solar energy, because there's a limit to what size of the solar panel on the roof you can have till you have to hire an outsourced energy company that takes your electricity and sells it back to you. So there is all sorts of strange stuff that's happening there that, again and again, as I said, all the extra unnecessary government intervention, maybe we can look into that. But again, I do think that that's reached its capacity in the Australian energy market.
See, that's interesting. You allow the market to decide on what technologies they're comfortable with, but we don't allow the market in Australia to make any assessment or invest or not invest in nuclear.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And for some reason, there's lots of scaremongering about nuclear. Everyone's talking about Chernobyl and those sorts of things. It's not like that. And I'm sorry, but Australia is quite a large country. We can build a nuclear power plant. If everyone is upset having it near you, there's space to build it far away from everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot more involved, but I cannot see the Parliament in its current configuration making any decision that will change the status quo.
Parliament, that's another problem. That's what's happening. Parliament is very dependent on the election cycle, and it's becoming more and more apparent that lots of policy are being thrown right before the election to pretty much by the votes. And that's becoming more and more concerning because we're not looking at the long-term horizon. And that's, for example, the immigration. That's with the pumping immigration because it solved the immediate problem, but it's not going to solve the problems in 10, 20 years. Because all these people, and I'm sorry going back to immigration, all these people going to get citizenship in 4 years.
Yeah, yeah. One last question. Bernie Sanders has come up with his four-day working week, but he's not going to change the amount of pay people are earning. That'll do nothing for productivity, will it?
Exactly. And the thing is, he claims that the people deserve 32-hour work week because they became more productive. Well, if they are that productive, why didn't they bargain and negotiate a higher pay for the 40-hour working week, the five-day one? Yeah. And in the United States, the labor market is a lot more volatile and the turnaround is a lot higher than here. And it's just normal. It's culturally appropriate over there. So you don't like the job, you quit and find another one. So it's a lot more efficient. So if it was indeed the case, workers would have just quit and find a better paid job for their skyrocketing productivity. What is overlooked in this argument, and Bernie Sanders is a bit of a socialist and likes to give a passport to every immigrant that crosses the border, what they call undocumented, this new word I learned. So they drive the supply. There's plenty of labor supplied that's crossing the border illegally, and they're driving the salaries down. Maybe if everyone was coming legally and the immigration was controlled properly in the United States, there were no talks about the 32-hour working week by Bernie Sanders, and you wouldn't have to legislate it. It would have been completely decided by the market itself. Well, yeah. Bernie Sanders probably remembers still the argument about the 40-day working week when after the Industrial Revolution, when it was 30 in the year 37, when they legislated the 40-hour working week in the United States. Haven't checked Bernie's age, but he could remember that.
No, I think you're right. I think he's about 80-something. I think you might be right. It's good to talk with you. It's good to have you on the program. Thank you for unpacking all of that today. It's a big day in terms of finance and economics. And I know you've got to get back into your next lecture. Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Pink.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Dr. Natalia Iloshina from the RMIT University, research fellow and economist. So interesting, isn't it? But, you know, it's just a typical, you know, socialist grab for votes. Oh, you know, we'll give you the same money, but you'll only have to work 4 days. Like, seriously, you know, leave us alone, seriously. Now, just from the Sydney Morning Herald, this is an interesting one before we go to news. New South Wales police strip search more than two dozen children, including a 12-year-old, in the 4 months to mid-February, despite a Minns government promise to review the controversial practice. A Freedom of Information request filed by the Herald suggested that New South Wales police continued strip searching children at the same rate as before the government review was announced. Strip searching children, in which police direct children to remove their clothes and sometimes to lift their genitals, usually without a parent or guardian present, has been criticised by health experts for causing serious long-term trauma and harm to children's development. In October, after the Herald reported that at least 115 girls and boys aged from 12 to 17 were strip searched in 2 years to June 2023, The Minns government committed to review the policies underpinning the practice and directed New South Wales Police to do likewise. An FOI request filed by the Herald shows police strip searched 26 children between the 18th of October 2023 and February 14, 2024. They found weapons only three times, prompting legal concerns that the police were often not meeting the legal threshold to justify a strip search. The Police Minister, Yasmin Catley, said she knew the data would be concerning for the community and that she had been meeting with key stakeholders over the past months on this matter. She said the very role of Minister is to consider the current policy settings, whether they're fit for purpose and how they affect the people of New South Wales. That's exactly what's been done in this instance. In doing so, it's important to balance community expectations with community safety. What are your thoughts on strip searching children if required, say at a concert, a music concert, and they occur just about every second weekend at Homebush, and that's where many of these strip searches take place. Maybe you've got a view on all of that. If you'd like to have your say, give us a call on our talkback numbers. Right now, I've got to get you some news. We're right on the news time and an update for you from the newsroom on TNT.
Turn on the news.
News flash.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. We're being warned to brace for an avalanche of new deaths in Gaza, not from combat, but rather starvation. The White House is refusing to admit whether it's still working with social media companies to censor speech it doesn't like. And the internet has been set alight after footage emerged of former US President Barack Obama paying a surprise, unannounced visit to British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in London.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction,
misinformation from the truth.
From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Tony from Stanmore in Sydney has sent me an email. Chris, listening to the replay with Jim Ball from sunny Bathurst, where I'm having a little bit of a break right next to Mount Panorama. It would be a little chilly in Bathurst. Well, it is chilly most of the time, but sunny Bathurst, it's best that it's sunny, I think, having been in Bathurst many times and listening to Jim Ball's show from last Friday. You're entitled to do that, Tony, but listen live at the same time if you can. All right. Many of us have become very disenfranchised from the political process. I know a lot of people who were avid political commentators and analysts in their own amateur way for many, many years, but they get browned off by the way things are bastardised by politicians, and that's understandably the case. We've become, I guess, statistics to policymakers, and many of our views and concerns are being ignored by the political class. My next guest seeks to redress this in a very unique way. Lawrence Pace is founder of For My Say, a platform dedicated to representing and empowering communities. From a modest upbringing, Lawrence took on the responsibility of managing delis by the time he was 13, laying the foundation for a career in business and entrepreneurial journey by the age of 17. He ventured into various sectors, including food distribution, food agencies, and the management of both state and national companies concurrently. He joins us live from Perth, WA. Lawrence Pace, welcome to TNT.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
That's okay. I guess the best way to set the scene for our audience is to hear a very short clip from your For My Say promotional video. Here you are here.
I'm Lawrence, and I've created a platform for you to have your say. You can be empowered, and you can share your thoughts and opinions in a supportive and secure way with For My Say. We're not influenced by governments or big business. The voices of enough people can help shape the future, our future. You answer questions each day, it's free, it's secure, all you need to do is download the app. Plus, you get to know what other users think about a range of issues and topics that affect us all. It's truly an honour to connect with you. I'm Lawrence Pace, the proud founder and CEO of For My Say. For My Say launched in Australia in June 2023 after years of investment of time, money and development of the app. So why is For My Say unique and why create it?
Lawrence, why is it unique in terms of, look, we understand about survey groups, they go and get basically a representative small sample to try and indicate, support, views, political bias or whatever, but it's usually done in a small group. This is a voluntary approach, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed it is. That in itself makes it unique because a lot of these polls that are out in the market often reward people for voting, which influences their, I guess, their honesty, if you like.
So hang on, what sort of awards are available for those who contribute?
Look, I'm not too sure, but often they might get a monetary reward over a period of a year for participating or other rewards. As you know, our platform doesn't reward anybody other than them getting a feeling of gratification when they have a look at the views of the community, and also particularly when their vote counts in changing something that the community is not happy with.
Okay, so what you are trying to do is get larger samples. You see, quite often you can talk to a surveyor or a manager who says, or a measurement analyst, and they'll say, oh, no, 200 for that population is quite acceptable because the 200 is made up of, 80 different category groups. But I can never understand how small samples can actually give you a decent representative result.
Chris, they're not accurate. I tried to develop this app in 2008-09. In those days, I spoke with the ABS and requested, how many people do you, I wanted to know whether they had information, how many people do you really know to have a sample of a population to indicate the true reflection of how people, feel in the community? Their figure was, in those days, was about 7,000 people. So as you know, there's probably no polling company in the world that has 7,000 people voting on any subject. So that was in the old days. These days, when I spoke to the ABS most recent times, they indicated, well, you need a significant figure of people. So 200, 300, 110 are not significant. So those polls are quite inaccurate. And there's they don't disclose a lot of stuff as well too. Firstly, they don't tell you how many people voted. They don't tell you if they were getting paid. They don't tell you where that sample came from. Are they all left wing, right wing, et cetera?
Okay. What sorts of surveys have you done so far?
Oh, God. Well, we've done hundreds and hundreds. We start off in June. Two questions go to the phones every single day, and people respond to those questions. And so we've done hundreds of surveys on all sorts.
So in your surveys, am I able to tell and get hold of data that I don't get from the official survey companies?
Well, that's really interesting. Firstly, the official survey companies don't release their data immediately. It may take time, it may take months, or they get paid for it by certain interest groups that have paid for that poll. Ours are done instantly. As soon as you answer on the phone, you see the results of how the community feel in real time. And our questions are live for 24 hours. So therefore, if you vote at 9 a.m. in the morning, you can go back into the phone and see if the figures have changed or the percentages have changed. So, and you see live results from the community. Now, why that's so interesting is that, we get results on political questions and other questions, but we also ask a lot of questions about sex, love, relationship, religion, all sorts of things. And these sorts of things aren't available in textbooks or in recent research. And particularly today, and I think more so since COVID has hit our planet, that it's reset a lot of thinking of people's minds. They don't feel the same way they did pre-COVID. They've changed their thinking. So what For My Say does, it gives the community an opportunity to give a current real-time view of their perspectives on any subject or on any issue.
Okay, one of the more recent surveys I saw had to do with who people trust and don't trust in reference to their news sources. What can you tell us about that survey?
Well, firstly, I was surprised. There was, I think from memory, there's about 53% listened to mainstream media for reliable and accurate news.
See, that's amazing. Now, I would have thought it would have been closer to 75.
Oh, really? I thought it should have been a lot lower.
Not what it should have been, but I would have. Yeah. But the fact that it's 53 tells me that the power and influence that legacy media has had on the population is waning.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it. But I still expected that figure to be around about 30%, people digested YouTube or other independent news channels on the internet to get reliable and accurate news. So I was shocked with that, you know. So, and it's not the first time I've been shocked. I've been shocked over many results. And that's the best thing about the app, because you see results our people feel instantly and often. They don't, you are not in the majority of that thinking.
That's interesting. What other aspects of that survey were standouts?
I guess it's not surprising that the introduction or the growth of our internet news, that we see a lot of that independent news. That was not that surprising to me, but I really didn't take anything more out of that.
Unless, so what was the number for independent news on the internet? Because we're one of them.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to have to look that up on the phone, if that's all right. But I think it was around about in the 20% region.
Okay. Yep. That's interesting. That's a growing sector, is it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We'll ask that question month by month and we'll see how those figures change, particularly in this day and age of misinformation, Chris, as you well know. It's pretty hard to get reliable and accurate news. In fact, I was just listening to your show this morning, and you're talking about what Trump said about a bloodbath and the way that's been pulled apart and distorted by mainstream media to make him look like he's inciting an insurrection again. So, you know, this is the more that comes out and is made more public, I think people aren't stupid. They'll realise that they can't get accurate news from mainstream media anymore.
Well, this is interesting. You know, the attempt by many governments, but that includes the Australian government, to have misinformation bureaus, to have, you know, the truth police set up in some kind of bureaucracy. How is that being received by the public? Have you done anything on that recently?
No, we haven't asked any questions in relationship to that. However, my personal views, if bureaucracy is involved, you can't trust it. So it's just more of the same. It's just more of a Band-Aid to try and cover up what's obviously happening in our society. And we're not only talking about misinformation. We're talking about, the vocal minority getting their way often over the silent majority. We're talking about the woke mentality and so on and so on. So governments, I find, aren't able and capable to run independent opinion polls or to be able to create trust in the community in order to get honest opinions from people.
Yeah. What do you do with the information that you gather, collate?
Great question. Well, this is what makes Formo Say different to every other polling company in the world. It goes to, we, as soon as the question closes, we have an automated system in the back end. We predetermine who those stakeholders are. Those stakeholders could be just the Prime Minister. It could be 76 senators. It could be, the Ombudsman, the Telecommunications Ombudsman, for example. There, we decide who that information will be relevant to. We choose that when we're raising the question. And then we choose the media who we want to be the recipients of that information as well too. And that's mainly all mainstream media. And then the process in the back end, as soon as that question closes at 12:01, the results get emailed to all those predetermined people.
So you predetermine this. You don't seek permission to send this information on. You actually say, well, this has got to have a great deal of interest, say, for instance, to the Auditor General, because we were asking a specific question. So you send that to the Auditor General?
Correct.
Right. That's a completely different... See, usually these agencies have to go and pay for the information and to get the information from someone like you, but you are getting on the front foot. That's an interesting approach. Why?
Transparency. We want the world to know how the community vote. Our commitment to every single user is we will make sure their voices are yelled at from every rooftop in Australia, and that's a way of doing it. We make sure all the mainstream media get a copy of those results. I must say that we haven't had one response from mainstream media. I don't think politicians, I don't think government, I don't think mainstream media are interested in what the community have to say, because no one's picked up the ball and ran with it. In fact, we've been going since June. I haven't had, or the company hasn't had any contact from any politician, following up, any minister, etc., any news media and mainstream news media. So it shows you there's a pushback on us, because in reality, these people do not want to know what the community thinks, because it interferes with their agendas.
That is frightening.
Yes, I agree.
So they're basically deciding we will set the narrative according to the way we in our newsroom or the management of our station dictate what that narrative should be. We don't need to look at a survey to find out what you want.
Well, personally, Chris, my view is that reporters have become subjected to their puppet masters. Once upon a time, reporters used to be the defenders of our democracy, investigate and report, all that sort of thing. Today, they just copy whatever they're told to print. So we've lost that. We've lost the defenders of our democracy. And then as far as our government goes, they have their own agendas. They don't, they're really not interested in you and me and the community in between election cycles. But all they're interested in is when they go to vote, they want your vote. But in between that, they don't give a rat's ass what you think or the community think. We have lobbyist groups. This is infiltrated every single parliament within Australia. These lobbyists are paid by these big corporations to go and lobby the government to get their will done through government. There's no consideration for how community feels about that. It's all about big business, protecting big business, which leads me onto my next point. You know, I've said in my previous videos that I've been very disillusioned the way our democracy has evolved, and that's true. I feel very, very disillusioned about that. And what I see in our community is that we've evolved to a plutocracy where the elites control our government, and their government goes along with that. And I can give you plenty of examples of that. You would have plenty of examples of that. But that's the reality of the world we live in. So how do we push back on all these issues? You know, we spoke about all the things in our society that are impacting each and every one of us heavily. It's the woke culture, the cancel culture. It's these minority of trans forcing their views upon us. And then we have our politicians. They don't care about us. They have their own agendas. They're self-serving. So they're held unaccountable. There is no accountability in our with our politicians, public servants, in our business leaders. So how do you push back? And the only way we can push back as a community is by coming together. And what this platform does is we can have 10 million people vote on this platform, and we can send that up the chain, and they have to pay attention to us. When we get volume people like that, they cannot ignore us anymore. They have to listen to what the public want, virtually.
Yeah. So if I was on your app, would I get reminders to say that there's a particular survey taking place now? Is that how it works?
No, you will get reminders. Every morning at 8:30, there's a notification that comes up and says you have questions waiting.
Right.
But we don't identify those questions, and you don't choose the category of the questions when you sign up at registration.
Okay, so for the time being, for my listeners, for my watchers, what can they do to get themselves this app, and what's it called? Is it easy to look for my say?
Yeah, absolutely. It's in both the Apple Store and Google Play.
Right.
but it is it's number four. Your listeners just have to remember, use the word the digit number four, and then my say, and just do a search, you'll come up, and then just follow the prompts and you'll download the app.
Okay, fascinating. Good luck with it. It's unique, as you say, and it can do a lot of good by the sound of it. And I hope it gets in the front of faces that wouldn't normally look at this stuff, because it's about time people, you know, in power, listen to what the people wanted. Great to have you on, Lawrence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Much appreciated. Thank you.
Fantastic to have you on. Lawrence Pace from For My Say. So it's the number four and then MYSAY if you want to download the app from the Apple Store or Play Store on an Android, and you can get your notifications at 8:30 every morning. As they say, there's another one waiting for you to fill out. And the more there are competing or contributing to this app, contributing to the surveys that are undertaken, well, the more accurate and the more indicative those results will be. And that's got to be good for all of us. Interesting concept. Lawrence Pace there from WA. Got to take a break. Quite happy to take your calls on any of that. What are your thoughts after listening to Lawrence? Would you like to take part? From the US or Canada, 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, 033-0024-1026. And from Australia or New Zealand, 1-800-670-310. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received two stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
Last week, Brandon met a girl on a dating app. One day after work, he finally found the courage to ask her out. No answer. He started to panic. Was he being too pushy? Maybe it was too...
Hey, sorry I didn't respond. I was driving. I would love to go on a date. How does tonight sound?
Brandon tried to play it cool, but inside he knew. A girl so smart, so responsible. She must be a keeper.
This is The Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Okay, good to have your company. Couple of quick things before we go any further. I wanted to get into Pelly's comment on the chat box, which you can be part of. Just go to tntradio.live, and while we're on air, you may have views to be expressed and you don't elect to come on to the talkback lines. That's fine. You can jump on to our chat box. And Pelly has said, mainstream media is about sensationalism and clickbait these days. Facts no longer matter. Can I just tell you, Pelly is aware of this and doesn't know how much he's correct or accurate. And a lot of the newspapers who operate at the moment dictate to their journalists at the moment how many clicks that they're looking for and how many lead to subscriptions, which are the big talking point. This is the big measurement as to what your work is worth, whether people go on and get subscriptions. And as you can imagine, the diehard journalists are tisking quite often because of this approach. But that's the approach. Clickbait. You're so right, Pelly. Thank you very much for all of that. Now, I want to give you some information out of Canberra. Australia's cyber defences have taken a significant leap forward with a collaboration between the Australian Signals Directorate, the ASD, and Microsoft. Now, the initiative, according to Computer Daily News, announced last October, aims to strengthen Australia's cyber defences across all business and government sectors. Now, the collaboration was mooted as part of Microsoft's $5 billion investment in Australia it pledged last year. The initiative sees the Australian Signals Directorate and Microsoft sharing operation details and cyber defence intelligence through their intelligence platforms. The Defence Department and Microsoft said it connects ASD's cyber threat intelligence sharing platform with Microsoft's Sentinel platform. The collaboration has resulted in what the ADF says is a cutting-edge global cyber threat intelligence system. Gee, it's good to hear that finally government is actually catching up with the cyber criminals. Now, it may not be the case, but at least they're progressing and going forward in that right direction. It enables Microsoft's Australian customers, who also partner in ASD's CTIS platform, to be able to share cyber threat information at the speed and scale required to mitigate against growing threats in cyberspace. Microsoft MD Stephen Worrell said, "We appreciate the opportunity to deepen our collaboration with the Australian government, building on 40 years of partnership since Microsoft began operations in Australia." Now, these combined platforms will also lead to deeper collaboration between ASD's CTIS program and Microsoft Sentinel customers in Australia. Microsoft says its cyber experts analyze 65 trillion signals of global threat intelligence every day. That is mind-blowing. This is what Microsoft does. Its cyber experts analyze 65 trillion signals of global threat intelligence every day. These are just threats. That's amazing. According to the Defence Minister, Richard Males, it is a collaborative partnership like these that foster innovation and deliver practical outcomes. The statement also emphasised the importance of the partnership between the public and private sectors in countering the cyber threats faced on all fronts. The new cyber defence initiative was unveiled as Home Affairs begins consultations on proposed changes to cyber security legislation. The legislation has got to catch up. And quite often when technology changes, the legislation is left lagging and way behind. Just very briefly, Federal Labor MP Andrew Charlton. This is the fellow, I think he's the member for Parramatta, isn't he? Yes, the seat of Parramatta for the Labor Party. He has forked out $12 million for a beachside investment home, $12 million investment home, not a place to live, to grow his real estate portfolio to around $42 million. Does it make you feel poor? Makes me feel poor. $42 million, and he's in Parliament. In a move that is likely to raise eyebrows given the current housing crisis and furore over negative gearing, Charlton, who won the seat of Parramatta for Labor at the 2020 federal election, has reportedly spent $12 million on the home in Palm Beach on Sydney's northern beaches. Imagine what you could rent out a $12 million home at Palm Beach for. During peak season, that's what he calls an investment property, a big investment. Palm Beach has long been a suburb of choice for getaway homes, according to realestate.com.au, for Sydney's elite to escape the city. The Packers are one family who have a long-held residence there. Charlton's new South Palm Beach home, which is called La Palma, is expected to hit the rental market when it settles later this year. It was owned by the state publican John Toohey and his wife Anna and hit the market in September with an initial $15 million guide. So he only got $12 million. Poor bloke. He wanted $15. He only got $12. La Palma is protected from the nor'easterlies by a bluff. It's got its own bluff. Has sweeping views of the coast, Barrenjoey Headland and Lion Island, and is in a tiny enclave off Pacific Road. You should just see the photos. You got to go on to realestate.com.au and have a look at the photos of La Palma. It's just out of this world. With interiors designed by Frank Grill, the four-bedroom, four-bathroom home with infinity pool. Of course, it's got an infinity pool and terrace and magnificent wine cellar and man cave. Now we're talking, has been held by the Toohey since 2002 when the couple bought it for $4 million. They sold it for $12. That is quite a profit. A profit over 22 years. I don't care. It's still a massive profit. It adds to an impressive portfolio for the Charltons, who was considered Kevin Rudd's economics whiz kid during his time as Prime Minister. Charlton was labelled a wannabe Westie in the lead up to the 2020 election when he was controversially nominated as Labor's candidate in North Parramatta. It's still funny, isn't it? He's got an Eastern Suburbs mega mansion. He's got a mega mansion in Palm Beach, which is only an investment for $12 million. And he's the member for Parramatta in the West. There is something socially conflicted by all of that. But anyway, I'm only jealous. I wish I had the $12 million to buy a Palm Beach investment unit. Sorry, investment palace. I am out of here. Sonia Poulton is up next, opening the innings, of course, from the UK today. We look forward to hearing her, and stick with her. We will be back to do it again at the same time. It is a Wednesday in 24 hours' time, so hopefully you can join me then right here on TNT.